Welcome to Enlightened Radio, www.enlightenedradio.org. And in case you want to see, you want to listen to the player. Now, if you're on a regular computer, the player always appears at the top of the page. But even so, Google Blogger claims to be, multi-device compatible on its websites. It doesn't always show up on www.enlightenedradio.org on some cell phones. So if you want to make sure you get to the player, even on a cell phone, you have to go to player.enlightenedradio.org. And of course, we have many podcasts from... I wish I had them all, but we have quite a few located on podcasts.enlightenedradio.org. And of course, you'll find shows there from this show, the poetry show coming up here with Janet Harrison. and also our other shows, Labor Beat, which we had a great show yesterday with Dr. John Aldous about whether or not the trade union movement, so to speak, is going to get interested in national health care anytime soon. And they actually already are interested in a lot of unions. But anyway, and then we have also James Boyd is doing his recovery radio show on Thursday mornings. And we have a Shepherdstown kind of spiritual, I call it Spirit of Shepherdstown. I guess we should call it Jefferson County since we're going to cover more than just Shepherdstown. But it's a replay of a show that Karen Valentine and I used to do on Fridays in Shepherdstown. And, of course, that's always kind of been it. We've been having a lot of priests on the show. So I'm not quite sure where we're going with that, but we're having the CATF people on this Friday. Anyway, this is the poetry show today, and Janet and I talked yesterday about introducing you to a classic poet of the Romantic era in English poetry, Percy Blythe. How do you say, it? Blythe, Percy Blythe Shelley.
Bysshe.
Oh, you say Percy Bysshe Shelley. Okay. See, there you go. Already, the expert is here. Anyway, and we're going to sort of experiment maybe with this idea of, in addition to, contemporary poets and poets that we know, we might try, working on a classic poem every now and then that sometimes the language or diction of the age, in this case, the 18th century, late 18th century.
early 18th century.
Is
1820.
It's before the, it's after the, but it's still in the French Revolutionary period. Okay, yeah, right, okay. Anyway, it makes it a little bit difficult to read if you're not a student of poetry, but we're going to give an effort this morning. And why don't you introduce what you know about Shelley and maybe his surrounding, his good friends, like his wife and, John Keats, to whom he composed an elegy almost as long as the Iliad. Okay, so anyway.
Well, the Romantic poets, you think of them as Keats, Byron, Shelley, and then in the Lake poets, Wordsworth and Coleridge. But Shelley and Byron hung out together and knew each other. In fact, might have shared a mistress at one point.
Wow.
Yes. Shelley was first married to a woman named Harriet. But while he was still married to Harriet, he met Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. And he and Mary Shelley then left the country together, left Harriet behind. Though Shelley's original idea was that all three of them should live together. Didn't work out.
It's an early hippie commune, yes, right? Why don't we go on as three?
They left the country, and he took Mary's half-sister, Claire, with him. And Claire was later to have a child. I'm not sure she had a child with Shelley. She certainly had a child with Byron.
Yeah,
but they apparently both had an affair with her. And Mary had several children, most of whom died.
Oh, really? One of Byron's children turned out to be a very famous mathematician, Ada.
I'm not sure if that was the child by Claire or if that was a child by another woman.
All right, okay.
Alba, that was.
Okay.
So anyhow, but Shelley died very young in a boating accident. He was only 29 when he died. He left a huge body of work behind, you know, for 29 years. It was pretty amazing.
Wow.
He wrote a lot of long poems, as well as the shorter poems and lyric poems like To a Skylark. He wrote a number of long poems, including Prometheus Unbound, which many people think is his masterpiece, about the myth of Prometheus, who was chained to a rock as punishment for stealing fire from the gods for humanity.
Right. It's almost a poetic anthem in a way, yes. Well, we were going to talk about the Skylark, To a Skylark poem. I think that's the one we're going to do today. And I should mention that I heard Fanny Crawford on the storytelling show read this the other day. And we asked her, well, that's a pretty difficult, kind of a difficult poem, at least to read aloud. And she said, well, she kept reading it 3 and 4 times, and every time she read it, it had a different message to her, you know, and that just fascinated her that there was so much going on in the poem. And I think we're going to try today to take a slow roll, as my son says, through this magnificent poem, very famous poem, and there have been poems written about this poem, quite a few, as a matter of fact. So, I don't know, Janet, how do we want to go about this?
I think you should read it first.
You try to read it first and then maybe go back and take a look at parts of it.
Go through, you know, slowly and, you know, but read it through all the way first.
All right. Now, I practiced, you know, this morning a little bit on this so I could not stumble over the 18th century language as little as possible. But I'll try to go slow and see if I can keep the context going. Hail to thee, blithe spirit. By the way, a skylark, before we go, a skylark is a small bird that sings a beautiful song, and you'll hear more about it as we go along here. Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art. Well, that's a little bit complicated. Let me do that one more time. Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art. Higher still and higher from the earth thou springest, like a cloud of fire, the blue deep thou wingest, and singing still dost soar, and soaring ever singest. In the golden lightning of the sunken sun, o'er which clouds are brightening, thou dost float and run like an unbodied joy whose race has just begun. The pale purple even melts around thy flight, like a star of heaven in the broad daylight. Thou art unseen, but yet I hear thy shrill delight. Keen are the arrows of that silver sphere, whose intense lamp narrows in the white dawn clear, until we hardly see, we feel that it is there. all the earth and air with thy voice is loud. As when the night is bare from one lonely cloud, the moon rains out her beams and heaven is overflowed. What thou art, we know not. What is most like thee? From a rainbow, clouds there flow not, drops so bright to see, as from thy presence showers a rain of melody. Like a poet, hidden in the light of thought, singing hymns unbidden, till the world is wrought to sympathy with hopes and fears it heeded not. Like a high-born maiden in a palace tower, soothing her love-laden soul in a secret hour, with music sweet as love, which overflows her bower. Like a glowworm golden in a dell of dew, scattering unbeholden its aerial blue among the flowers and grass which screen it from view. Like a rose embowered in its own green leaves by warm winds deflowered, till the scent it gives makes faint with too much sweet those heavy-winged thieves. Sound of vernal showers on the twinkling grass, rain awakened flowers, all that ever was, joyous and clear and fresh, thy music doth surpass. Teach us, sprite or bird, what sweet thoughts are thine. I have never heard praise of love or wine that panted forth a flood of rapture so divine. Chorus, hymn and eel, or triumphant chant matched with thine would be all but an empty vaunt, a thing wherein we feel there is some hidden want. What objects are the fountains of thy happy strain? What fields or waves or mountains? What shapes of sky or plain? What love of thine own kind? What ignorance of pain? With thy clear, keen joyance, languor cannot be. Shadow of annoyance never come near thee. Thou lovest, but ne'er knew love's sad satiety. Waking or asleep, thou death must deem things more true and deep than we mortals dream. Or how could thine notes flow in such a crystal stream? We look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is also fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought. Yet if we could scorn hate and pride and fear, if we were things born not to shed a tear, I know not how thy joy we ever should come near. Better than all measures of delightful sound, better than all treasures that in books are found, thy skill to poet were, thou scorner of the ground. Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world should listen then as I am listening now. So that's the poem.
First thing I want to say about the poem is that it's got a rhyme scheme. It's got a very strict rhyme scheme. It's got five line stanzas, and they rhyme A, B, A, B, A. A B, wait a minute. A, B, A, B, B. So, and the last line is longer than the first four lines. It's got four short lines and then one last line that rhymes with the second and fourth line, but it's longer than those lines.
Have you ever seen that particular form before with the long last line?
Not that I recall.
Yeah, I couldn't remember
form.
One.
I think
but
he made it up for this poem.
So
like in the first line, "Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou'll never work, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art." You have the rhyme between spirit and near it, between word, heart, and art.
Yeah. Right.
But that last line is in profuse strains of unpremeditated art is longer than the first four lines. So that's the structure of the poem. He carries that down throughout the poem. So even if you got lost in the sense of this poem because of the syntax, the 19th century syntax, you could hear the music of the work of the poem carried throughout, and it's about a musical subject, so it's right that the poem should have so much music in it.
Right. No. Yeah, it's very harmonious, you know, sounding. I mean, and parts of it are just beautiful the way they it flows differently in some verses than in others. Some seem to be more reflective, others seem to be let's move downstream a little bit, you know, kind of feeling that I got about it anyway. I thought that it's you know, there's an aspect of romantic poetry that is, you know, a little bit always flirting with feet planted in midair kind of sentiments, I'll call them. You know, that was especially true of Wordsworth, for example, you know, and where there's a lot of reflection and a lot of kind of airy thoughts and not as much emotion, you know. But I thought this poem had an interesting balance, right, between the reflection part and, you know, I wish I could fly above the earth, and I wish, you know, this that kind of longing that we all probably feel when we see, you know, birds in flight. But he wraps so much nature, the sun, the moon, you know, the environment, you know, other forms of beauty, and how the skylark lifts above it all, and I thought that's not an uncommon theme in romantic poetry. That's you know, free to dream, not so much in the Middle Ages, right? So. Of course, Carol and I just finished, you know, this whole long, great history of the French Revolution, and part of that was referring to its impact on poetics and literature and culture, and I think actually she quoted a poem by Shelley actually in the process, but and you know, and the impact of the Enlightenment along with this social upheaval that was going on pretty much everywhere in Europe at the time. I just find it amazing. It looks to me like for such a short life, I mean, he poured out a lot of poetry. And when you look at some, most of the poetry is pretty structured too. So he must have been able to write a villanelle, you know, just without thinking about it. Something I can't do. Anyway. The structure is good, but doesn't it usually take a lot of work? I mean, much more work than another kind of poem, maybe? What do you think? You're the poet.
For me, it's more difficult, but he seems to have pulled this off without seeming to strain too much.
Right, Well, and some of the rhyme. I love the verse that ends in melody.
Okay, let me find,
you know, that's
that
just
one.
I think it's about two-thirds of that way down somewhere. That I don't know why I didn't expect that rhyme, but it came upon me, and I thought it was just beautiful the way that, let's see, pain.
It says, what thou art, we know not.
Right.
Okay, and normally that syntax would be read something, we do not know, we know not what thou art. But for the rhyme, he has to invert it. So what thou art, we know not. What is most like thee? From rainbow clouds there flow not drops so bright to see as from thy presence showers a rain of melody.
Yeah. I thought that was great. Okay, just...
And he carries the metaphor of the rainbow clouds down into the showers of rain of melody. That metaphor.
Yeah, it's just... And also, the way that it ends, I mean, the world should listen then as I am listening now. Where it's just present tense, right? I mean, it's not longer a reflection. When you get to that last line, I just woke up. Oh, wow. I mean, I just finished the poem. I just left the poem, you know? I should go up, open the window and listen to the sky, to a skylark. Of course, there's lots of birds chirping right now in our backyard, but I don't know that there's any skylarks, but, anyway, by the way, what does the word satiety mean? S-A-T-I-E-T-Y.
Is that being sated.
Being satisfied, being... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Satiety, being the state of being sated.
Yes.
Right. That's a little awkward, but...
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether anyone ever, you know, in 1820, whatever, ever said the word satiety. Maybe, but... Nobody says it now. You know, so. What are the, so did, the some of the, I mean, I have, it's been a while since I studied this, but do you have a sense of what portion of the these romantic poets, like the ones you mentioned? I don't remember Wordsworth having much rhyme in his poems. Maybe he did in a few.
Yeah, but... he's written a lot of sonnets.
Oh, that's right. He did write sonnets. Okay, so, okay. I was just thinking of Tintern Abbey. I don't remember that one writing. But, and so probably most of them were fairly, I mean, Keats' poems were fairly, the odes were very tightly structured. I don't know as much. I'm not as familiar with Byron, except for a few things.
Byron wrote the long poem Don Juan with lots of rhyme in it.
Right. Don Juan rhymes with ruin, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So actually the era of free verse hadn't actually come into being that much yet, right?
No, not that much. Some people might have been experimenting with it. I can't remember, but there was a lot of structure, a lot of rhyme in poetry, in the Romantic poets.
Right.
The stanza I want to look at right now is the one about waking or asleep. Thou of death must deem things more true and deep than we mortals dream. Or how could thy nights fly in such a crystal stream? And this idea of death, that this bird must have thoughts of death that are deeper and truer than we mortals dream. That was an unusual, that surprised me in the poem.
Right.
I wouldn't have thought about the bird having any thoughts of death whatsoever. But he considers that it has thoughts of death, but they're truer and deeper than we dream, or else how could thy notes flow in such a crystal stream?
Right. Well, you know, we the miracle of life, right?
Yes.
As it appears to us, it's hard not to reflect upon it without, you know, wondering at its miraculous aspect, right? So... Yeah, but he touches these kinds of reflections, a lot of them, and that's what the poem does kind of overflow in a way. By the way, a glowworm. Like a glowworm, golden in a dell of dew, scattering unbeholden its aerial hue among the flowers and grass, which screen it from view. But now the glowworm was a, I watched a movie, I think it was something, a Roman thing, or Marcus Aurelius or something like that, and the glowworm was actually a big long train of people carrying torches, but it had in myth it became a creature of some sort that would go through the forest and be a scary thing. Does that make sense to you? Is that, I mean, because but that's from a movie I just watched. I think Gladiator. Okay, a decade ago. Where does this glowworm golden come from? Is it actually similar?
I wonder if it was. I thought it might have been a firefly, but I could be wrong.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, could
you
be.
Yeah, an insect that glows because it had. Let me see if I find that. That stanza. We compare it to every different kinds of things. He likens it first to
a glow. Well, he's likening the bird to all kinds of different images, really.
Rainbow clouds, then it's to a poet, then it's to a high bird Mary, then a glowworm golden in a dell of dew, scattering on bird. It's aerial here. When it said aerial, it made me think of something that flew. So a glowworm, right. Something flying. So I thought among the flowers which screen it from view.
Yeah, right. Among the flowers and grass, which screen it from view. That might probably a firefly. Yeah, that makes more sense.
And then he goes on with the rose, you know.
When you say a rose embowered, what does that mean to you?
Like in a little garden that's enclosed. A bower is the room, so a little enclosed garden. And it's embowered in its own green leaves. It's in its own green leaves because create a little house like around it.
Right.
Then the winds penetrate that, you know, by warm winds to flower and carry the scent away. You know, makes faint too much sweet. Those heavy winged thieves. It's like a rose protected, but the wind can get to it and carry it and steal its scent.
Ah, steal it's the heavy winged thieves. Yes. Oh, that's okay. Well, now that helps because I struggled with that one a bit. there was another one here I wanted to. Teach us, sprite or bird, what sweet thoughts are thine. I have never heard praise of love or wine that poured forth a flood of rapture so divine. That was I thought that was really nicely composed.
Yes.
I don't know what, you know, when I first read, I don't know what hymeneal is. What is that?
A wedding chorus.
A wedding chorus. Okay. All right.
It refers to the god that oversees weddings.
I see.
Had to look that one.
Okay. I'm glad. All right. Well, that's interesting that in that one, that compared to the bird's song, this triumphal chant and a wedding chorus would be an empty bond.
Thing wherein we feel there is some hidden want.
Right.
We can't match this bird.
Right.
So even our highest
hymns,
most,
so to speak, yes.
Joyous moments.
Fall short. Yes, right, yes.
Don't match the song of this bird.
Right.
And so he asks, what causes a bird to sing? What fields or waves or mountains? What shapes of sky or plain? What love of thine? Oh, kind, what ignorance of pain. So he's saying the bird is ignorant of pain. Even though earlier he said the bird was aware of death but had thoughts deeper.
But then he goes straight on, really, that it is the pain that or the that lets us appreciate the joy of the bird's song. And it's interesting how he weaves that back. What love of thine own kind, what ignorance of pain. But down below, see, yes, we look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought.
Now, that's he's talking about the human condition.
Yes. He's moved from the bird to himself or to the humans.
Yes.
And it's just.
And he says, if we could scorn hate and pride and fear, if we were things born not to shed a tear, I know not how thy joy we should ever come near. So he's saying, even if we were born, you know, without this mixture of laughter and pain,
right.
If we scorned hate and pride and fear and things born not to shed a tear, which is, of course, is not humanity's state,
right.
I know not how thy joy we ever should come near. Again, the syntax is a little inverted because of the rhyme there.
Right.
You know, he says,
right.
You know, even if we were born without this sadness and pain, we still couldn't match this bird's song.
Right. On the other hand, I know not how thy joy we ever should come near if we were born not to shed a tear. See, that's
even if we were born, we still couldn't match the bird.
But in a way, our grief lets us hear it more, right? I mean, there's a balance in there that he's trying to seems to tune in. He's trying to tune better than all better. Oh yes. Thy skill to the poet were the, our scorner of the ground. Now, you need to comment on that, Janet. So with that, we emulate the skylark because as a poet, we scorn the ground. How does that fit in your, how do you react to that?
Well, you have to go back for the whole stanza. Better than all measures of delightful sound. So it's better than any measure of delightful sound. Better than all the treasures that in books are found. It's better than anything that's been found in the books. Thy skill to poet were, it's your skill is better than any poet's skill. And then he addresses the bird as thou scorner of the ground. Because the bird is the scorner of the ground.
Yeah, right.
And then he implores in that last stanza, teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world should listen then as I am listening now. And the
right.
world didn't listen to Shelley very much when he was alive. His reputation grew after he was dead.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
So he hears this bird and he muses on all kinds of different things. But he ends up envying the bird and employing the bird to teach him. And it's very interesting. He says, that thy brain must know, not, you know, your heart or whatever. It says, you know, treat me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Not thy mind, but thy brain. Going back to the anatomy. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world should listen then as I am listening now.
Do you sometimes? Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
He wants the world to listen to his poetry as intently as he's listening to the skylark. But he thinks he needs something from the skylark first before he can write verse that the world would listen to that intently.
Harmonious madness. Do you have that sense at times? Harmonious madness, Janet?
Well, that's a loaded question for me.
Well, I think for most people, since we're all on the spectrum, so that one touched me listening to that. But
Shelley was scorned because he was an atheist at a time when religion was very important. He wrote a poem. He wrote an essay with another man he met, I think, at Oxford, on atheism. And right. So he was scorned by many people because of his beliefs and because of his immorality in going away with Mary when he was still married to Harriet.
Right. It's
and he was Harry. He had two children by Harriet, but they wound up being put in foster care rather than being given to him and Mary, even after he married Mary, because he was deemed immoral and an atheist and unsuited to raise his children.
Right, unsuited to raise children. Right, yeah, right. Well, you know, if the well, let's don't go there, because we might have to relive that challenge again sometime soon. Anyway, well, we've spent a solid half hour on Percy Bysshe Shelley's To a Skylark, and I don't know, I think I've had fun doing it, Janet. I think we have about a half hour here. Do you have any closing thoughts on this poem? And
Just that the skylark has a beautiful song, but it's not a remarkable bird, and he elevates it into something that's even more than a bird. He refers to it as a sprite or a spirit many times. Right. So he's invoking something more than just the physical bird. Right. And so I think my suggestion would be just to go out in nature somehow, even if it's just to a little park or by a tree or whatever, and just observe something and then write about what you observe in a way, reflecting on it.
Right.
Maybe even a little, personification like he does here.
Right. And don't fear if your mind wanders into a harmonious madness on the way. It'll be okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for this. And by the way, next week, are we thinking about the poet that you are, Diane Blakely? Is that what we're thinking of doing next week?
Yeah, I think so. And her duets with Robert Johnson. And so we'll probably play one of Robert Johnson's.
Oh, okay. Just make sure I know which Robert Johnson thing you wanted to play. I have quite a bit.
Yeah, I'll give you the poems. We'll play one of the songs that matches the poem. Because all of her poems in this collection have titles from his songs.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. So that makes a lot of sense. So
the meditations that they're sort of, she calls them duets with him.
Oh, that's great. That's
right. Of course, the great Delta blues man only has left a few recordings.
That's true.
With a great legend that he met the devil at the crossroads and the devil taught him how to play guitar.
3230. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, by the way, if you want to get in touch with us at the Poetry Show, you can always go to www.enlightenradio.org, and you'll notice on all the podcasts that there's contact information where you can get a hold of myself, John Case. And there's also a poetry.enlightenradio.org site that I am now posting our shows too. Okay, so there, you can go there. I don't know whether there's contact information on that page though, but on most of them there is, and so feel free to get a hold of us, jcase4218@gmail.com, and if you want to be on the show, or you want us to take a look at your poetry, or if you got
or you want to suggest a classic poem for us to revisit. We're going to try and do this once a month.
Yeah, try to suggest a classic poem you'd like us to get into and delve into and see what we can do with it. In the meantime, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next. Janet, I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Sure.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.